Okay, I'm in the social science building, and I'm interviewing Professor James Stern, and the date is July 8th, 1987. And do I have your permission to interview you?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to start out by asking you to give me a little information about yourself, the various positions you've had, and your graduate, where you took your undergraduate and graduate degree.
Don't you have all of that on the Vita downstairs?
I have some of it, but for the purposes of the tape, I wanted you to give me the highlights, if you
could. My undergraduate degree is from Antioch College, 1943, in engineering. I subsequently was in the naval service during World War II, decided I didn't want to be an engineer anymore, went to work for unions for a while, then decided I wanted to get a PhD in economics, which I did from University of California, Berkeley in 1954. I had also worked for the Marshall Plan in Europe, and also back to work for the United Automobile Workers Union until 1962, at which point when the University of Michigan was exploring with me the possibility of going into academic life, Wisconsin also came into the picture, and I liked the lake here better than the atmosphere in Ann Arbor, and came here and have been here since.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about how you came to be director of the Industrial Relations Institute. I know that you had a couple of stints, at least. What the process was, I'm curious as to what the process was to designate a director during the times that you were elected or appointed or...
Well, the process is a little more formal now than it used to be. And are you interested in learning what the process was, or did you want to know how I became director?
Both. I wanted to learn whether there was a formalized process, if not, how you became director, if it was different.
Well, what really happens is that the former director picks his successor.
Mm-hmm.
And the procedure used is usually a search committee, but since the director appoints the search committee, he has a pretty good idea of which way it'll go.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about the directorship process is that there was a dramatic change when Reed Tripp left and Jerry Summers took over, and then I succeeded Jerry. Before that time, the directorship had been a permanent position in the sense that the incumbent, once in, was not dislodgeable except under extreme circumstances, such as the Regents getting rid of Fleming.
Mm-hmm.
And then Reed Tripp leaving to go to Lehigh. And through Fleming, Young, and Tripp, each one of these individuals considered the job a self-renewing job. When Tripp left, Jerry Summers became the director, and I was active at that time. And this was the time of democracy, and we agreed that the Institute should be run in the same fashion as a department, that is, with a chairman who served for 3 years, subject, of course, to renewal each of the 3 years, but then at the end of 3 years got out.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think the credit for going to that system should go to Jerry Summers. And so that the process then became analogous to that of picking a chairman for a regular department. Since all of us came from economics, we in effect just took the procedure of the economics department and placed it into effect in industrial relations.
Mm-hmm.
So that after Jerry served his 3-year term, there was a search committee, and they just asked me if I would be director, and I agreed yes. And after I completed my tour, I did the same thing, and there was a successor. And
mm-hmm.
This has gone on now through each of the directors in the same process.
Mm-hmm.
So that I guess I've been instrumental in picking a few of the directors just as being head of search committee. And our search committee now is usually composed of former directors.
Mm-hmm.
And that way we perpetuate this business of a director serving for 3 years and being selected or being nominated by former directors.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the region's getting rid of Fleming. I've already spoken to Mr. Fleming, and could you elaborate on that a little bit? I know there were a lot of tensions between various departments, institutions within the university.
Oh, I didn't think that had anything to do with it. The story I've heard, and it mm-hmm. may well be apocryphal, you'll have to check this with Bob, mm-hmm. is that we had a strong school for workers representing labor, a strong management institute representing management, and our regents thought we ought to have a neutral institute. So that Nate Feinsinger and Ed Whitty and others brought in this young man, Robin Fleming, and he set up a neutral institute. He then ran a conference on union security, and this must have been back in 1947 or 48, and that was a very hot topic at that time. And the conference came out in favor of the union shop, at which point the governor, who was opposed to the union shop, and the regents decided that they really didn't need what was then called, by the way, the Industrial Relations Center,
mm-hmm.
and abolished it. And therefore Fleming went to Illinois. Fleming did not have an appointment other than his appointment
mm-hmm.
running the institute. The faculty who were here recreated this center, calling it the Industrial Relations Research Center,
mm-hmm.
and focused on research rather than on public policy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the story I was told when I came here,
mm-hmm.
but I came in 62, and this all happened 15 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what Fleming says, too?
He doesn't quite say that the center was abolished. I think mm-hmm. he made it clear that it was a matter of choice. There was a larger budget at this other institute that he went to in Illinois, and that they offered him more money, that sort of thing. And he was quite, I think, clear that things weren't working too well. I haven't seen any kind of act of the
regions. Did you ask him what his position was?
On what?
No, was he a member of the faculty?
No, he wasn't a member of the faculty.
Okay, all right.
No, he wasn't. He did, I think, have an associate professorship appointment, though not to any kind of specific department. It was kind of nebulous as to what was going on then. Trying to clarify.
I think you should ask Ed Yang about that, since he was here during that period, and he and others can explain pretty well what happened.
Yeah.
Bob Ozan also would know about it, and Dave Johnson might as well. Stories get cleaned up a bit over the years.
They sure do. I'm curious, did you have much connection with Elizabeth Brandeis while you were here?
I liked her very much, and had contact with her as a colleague.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife and E.B. were good friends, and we saw the Rauschenbusches socially,
mm-hmm.
go to theater together, things like that. We served on committees together, and she was a beautiful woman, and an interesting woman, and a very nice person, too.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to know about E.B.?
Did you get a sense from her how she felt being a woman in a field that was largely dominated by men, or almost completely dominated by men?
Well,
both within the department and her extra-departmental activity.
I can't tell you unless you turn off the tape recorder.
Okay, well, that'll be for when I turn off the recorder.
Yeah, I'd be glad to tell you, but not, for use in our history or anything.
Okay. We'll come back to that then. I wanted to speak now about your tenures as director. What were the important considerations and concerns that you remember?
We're talking about 68, I guess, to 71. So isn't that the time I had?
68 to 71 and 79 to 83.
Well, let's take the first one first.
Mm-hmm.
we're talking almost 20 years ago, so it's very difficult to remember what's what. And unless you look at the documents of the specific crises that we faced and refresh my memory with those, I'm afraid that I might leave out great and important events. My recollection is that my main dull, mundane, continuing function was to clean up our act. For example, I had to get agreement from the graduate school that we could give master's and PhD degrees. We had been giving them, and there was some question as to whether we had approval or not. So we had to get that cleaned up. That was sort of typical of what was going on. We were hiring people, but we didn't have budget lines, so that had to be cleaned up. We had some secretarial and office problems of a mundane nature again, which had to be handled, because our prior method of operation had been somewhat irregular. And I guess my main concern during the 3 years was just trying to make sure that we fit adequately into the university, which was also going through all types of changes. So it was mainly to try to make the IRRI into a department in the sense of its structure, with its committees, with its budget, with its giving of degrees, and space. As I remember, the university then invented a space committee or something of that nature, or hired a guy. Let's see, his name was Forrest Todd. We had one of his, son as a student, a very nice guy, and a fellow by the name of Sager. And they were always going around the building trying to reallocate space. And we had a new building here, and space was very valuable. So whether SOC would get space, Econ would get space, IR would get space, or Anthro, when you look back on what you had to spend time on, one of the considerations, as well as the ones I've already mentioned, was space. Then there was budget. Things were pretty loose in those days, so the budget wasn't as much of a consideration as it was during the second time I served as director. But you did have to worry about it. So those were the main administrative chores that were involved.
Going back to the committees, when were the various committees formed? I know that the executive committee and the faculty committee dates back to the origins of the center in the 40s. But when, if you do remember this, when the admissions committees were formed, the other committees associated now with the institute.
I think I can help you partially, but you'll have to talk to Dick Miller and a few others about how we change things, and even more reliable than any of us are would be the record. We started out with an advisory committee that was totally meaningless. It was, I shouldn't say totally meaningless, it was important in a sense that it consisted of one person from each of six or seven departments. Then Jerry, who was from economics, Jerry Summers, wanted to get me on the committee, so we changed the arrangements so that chairs of some of our standing committees would be on our executive committee. Then, when I became director, I wanted to broaden our committee so that we increased our committee structure. And we had associate directors at that time. Jerry had as his associate director Al Philly, and I had Dick Miller. And therefore, we could divide work up. As I recall, Dick would handle some committees, I would handle others. He would do the MA exam, I'd do the PhD exam. Those are just illustrations. Those may not be correct, but that's my recollection.
Mm-hmm.
So, in answer to your question of committee structures, I would say that we got into pretty full committee structures by 1970.
Mm-hmm. How about the Center for Vocational and Technical Education, which I know jointly issued the IRRI reports for many years, and have since...
No, the IRRI reports were issued actually by the Industrial Relations Research Institute.
With a section for the center,
yeah,
usually.
Right.
Can you elaborate a little bit what the connection was between the two?
Well, Jerry Summers was director of the Institute, and during his tenure, he got this $1 million Ford grant. One of the conditions of the Ford grant was to set up a Journal of Human Resources, which was done. A second was to attract social scientists and others into this field of vocational education. So that Jerry made arrangements with Merle Strong over in VocEd and others to set up this Center for Vocational Education. But it was really Jerry's center. And it was a mechanism for spending the Ford money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do you want to know specifically about it?
In terms of day-to-day, committees, in terms of joint endeavors, was there a sort of an ongoing connection? Were they separate institutions for the most part?
That's like asking a married man, when were you a father, when were you a husband, and so on. Jerry Summers was director of the center and director of the VocEd project.
Mm-hmm.
When we put out a reprint with a red border on it, it was from the center. When it had a blue border,
mm-hmm.
it was from vocational education.
Mm-hmm.
How did we decide which ones to put into which? Well, it depended where we needed more publications. Illustrate this for you. Here's one that we did in 1970, you see, with a red cover.
And that meant the IRRI?
Yeah, and here's one with a blue cover.
Uh-huh.
And, so, I'm not sure how to answer your question other than to say that if you were doing research, which you can have this if you want. If you were doing research which had to do with VocEd, well, we'd put it into the VocEd side. If you were doing research outside of VocEd, then it went the other way. If you were looking for some money, and we had more money on the VocEd side, and you could make your proposal look like VocEd, then it got financed out of VocEd.
Mm-hmm. So it's a tremendous amount of overlap between them.
Well, you had the same people involved in it, with some exceptions. There were some straight VocEd projects running bibliographies. Merle Strong did most of that. You'll have to ask him about it.
Mm-hmm. By the way, and I haven't gotten to this yet in my looking at the record, when was the center? And also, I'm not sure if it even exists anymore, the Vocational and Technical Education Center.
We gave it back to VocEd, I think.
Oh, okay.
By the way, you ought to get the date when the Industrial Relations Center became the Industrial Relations Research Institute.
That there was also an intermediate phase where it became the Industrial Relations Research Center and then became the Institute.
Right.
I think that was in the 50s, right? 50s when it became the center.
Right, and we had to become an institute when we took the VocEd Center.
Was that why?
That's my recollection, because
uh-huh.
institutes can have centers within them. And so I think Jerry changed their name to Institute in order to put his VocEd Center within the institute. You see, he could put the Boca Ed Center in economics or over in Boca Ed or any place like that, but he decided to put it down in industrial relations, and the main thing that he tried to do with the money he had was to get scholars from, say, sociology, psychology, economics, to look at vocational education, because in the past, the people who had looked at vocational education were really not top-flight scholars from a wide variety of social science disciplines. It was a much more narrow field.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the hope of the Ford Foundation that through this approach, we could shed new light on how to educate people.
I wanted to know, during your, or first of all, just the concerns and the considerations that you mentioned, that do they apply both to the, to both tenures, or were there specific things that happened during the later, your later?
The first tenure was much more informal, and everything I've said so far goes back toward that first tenure. I have to keep in mind that as an institute, we had no problems fitting into the university because we were operating in an environment where there were former institute directors running the university,
mm-hmm.
Bob Fleming and Ed Young and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ed Young did us dirt when he decided that instead of having the institute report to the chancellor, he would have it report to the dean.
Mm-hmm.
And the notion was that department shouldn't go directly to the chancellor. So that it went to the dean. I guess Leon Epstein was dean at that time, and then after that it was Tom Cleaney. And Leon's an old buddy of mine with whom I play tennis all the time, so we didn't have any great problems. And what I learned from him, and it was still true with Cleaney, that when I went over with, we need to hire somebody, or we need more money for this or that, and so on, that they would look at it and nod, say, well, we'll see, and then they just send it over to Ed Young. So that, practically speaking,
mm-hmm.
The chancellor's office was still our guardian angel and so on during that first term.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second term was entirely different because by that time we had been sort of part of Letters and Science, responsible to the dean.
Mm-hmm.
We had as a chancellor somebody who wasn't out of the labor background at all.
Mm-hmm. Who was chancellor at that time?
Well, Irv Shane is the one I'm thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to go off the record again to tell you all about that.
Okay, I'll put that. I'll put that down. You have the record. Later.
Mm-hmm. But basically, our favored position disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, we were treated during the late 70s and in the 80s in a much less favorable way than we had been in the past. But this was a function of the fact that the university as a whole was being squeezed for money.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're squeezed for money, you react as do any of the animals, crabs or something. You withdraw your tentacles, you protect your basic turf, so that the established departments, be they history, English, chemistry, economics, math, those are the ones you've got to protect if you're going to keep your university strong.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that are interdisciplinary programs on the perimeter are the ones that really get hit hard by budget restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
So that in the second phase as director, you were really fighting to force the university to keep the program going.
Mm-hmm.
The program is a moneymaker for the university and has a good reputation, and no one would knowingly say we should not have the program.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to allow other departments to expand, and you're not going to allow the IR program to do certain things which its faculty thinks should be done, then it's a very difficult situation. So the second term was one where I felt that we had to fight hard to maintain ourselves. Now, let me give you a specific example. We had three project assistantships, which were the property of the Institute. In other words, we had in our budget funds to support three project assistants. We could use these for insurance, so that for our graduate students, when a student would write in and ask whether there was financial help and so forth, if the student was a good student and our committee so recommended, we could offer a project assistantship. Mm-hmm. Now, our faculty would have probably a half a dozen project assistantships coming up, but these would be sort of loose. They weren't sure they'd get them from the grad school. They weren't sure that the student who was on it at present could be used on it. So the three institute ones were our insurance. We knew we could offer something, mm-hmm. because if the faculty ones didn't come through in the right numbers, we had these to fall back on. Well, the Dean of Letters and Sciences decided that we should not continue to have these and took them away from us. Now, our argument was that since we are a graduate program without undergraduate courses in any number and no freshman and sophomore courses, that we had no teaching assistants, and therefore we could not use this as the basis. The dean was not sympathetic to that, so I suggested, all right, we'll take one of our courses and drop it down to the 200 level, such as an introduction to labor relations, and ask for a teaching assistant for it. The dean's office blocked that, said, no, you can't do that. And really, the reason for it was that this would be taking students away from, say, anthropology. Because students were becoming more interested in jobs than they were in general education. Now, the dean's a historian and so forth, so that he was sympathetic to the needs of the standard departments, and he could see us building the program at a lower level. And he had some intellectual reservations, ones which I share. I'm not sure people should get into vocational types of courses as freshmen and sophomore, or even as juniors and seniors. So there's a legitimate debate. But I was not about to agree with him on that point when he was taking away our project assistantships and was refusing to let us get teaching assistantships. Now, I use that as an example of a problem we have, and it's one that has not yet been solved. Our enrollment is smaller than it should be because Cornell, for example, has a lot more financial aid for students, so a lot of good students are going there instead of here. Mm-hmm. And I would guess Craig Olson, as the incoming director, is going to have some problems on this one. Mm-hmm. I hope that illustration gives you an idea of the problems of an interdisciplinary program as opposed to a department.
How did the, there's been, not conflict, but there's been tensions between the Institute and the Department of Economics, the School of Commerce, especially during its early years. And I wondered what the relationship of the Institute was to these, I would say, the School of Commerce, Department of Economics, and the School for Workers, and how that changed from one directorship to the other for you.
I had no problems during either term with any of these, with business, Econ or School for Workers. Mm-hmm. And I'm not aware of any great overriding problems. We had some problems with different personalities, but I didn't run into any problems on that score. Mm-hmm. I guess there is one, which is another example of the problem of an interdisciplinary program. We are lodged in LMS, therefore we are budgeted out of LMS. Assume I go off to Australia, as I want to do, and somebody has to teach my course. If that person is from LMS, the dean of LMS doesn't care, because there's no increase in his budget. But if the director of the institute wants somebody from the School of Business to teach it, or somebody from the law school to teach it, then there's a problem. Who's going to pay for it?
Mm-hmm.
So I can recall convening meetings over in our chancellor's office where we had the different deans there and saying, look, this is not an additional expenditure to the chancellor. And it's ridiculous for you guys to say that June Weisberger from the law school can't teach for me, cover my public sector bargaining course, because Cronin doesn't have the money. And so there was great discussion about this, and we really didn't get too much settled, but on an ad hoc basis, we got things settled. It was agreed that law would pay for June the first time, and we'd pay the second time.
Mm-hmm.
When it came the second time, Cronin was out of money and he wouldn't pay,
mm-hmm.
so I guess law paid twice. Then when it was Miller and the business school, we had all sorts of problems the same way, and then there would be discussions between Cronin and, what's his name, the present dean, Hitch.
Of the business school?
Yeah. Oh, Lord. Hitchman, I guess it is. But at any rate, these deans would have all sorts of problems going on about sharing expenses, and we would get caught up in their problems. So that in one case where we had agreement on who would be the director of the institute, we got blocked because of a fight between deans and how much this person would be compensated for.
Mm-hmm.
So that although I'm not talking at all about what I think you've got in mind, which is the old conflicts about the institute, the ones I was exposed to in the 78 period, or whenever I was director the second time, I don't have the dates in front of me, were these ones of who would pay for costs, how you would handle teaching costs. That's reasonably well straightened out, but has to be brought up every year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are you referring to, the personality fights over the years that may have existed?
I was referring to whether the sort of early tensions had, I was curious as to whether they had transplanted themselves in the later years, and whether the same things were working out. One thing that someone mentioned was that there was kind of an ongoing problem of teaching methods, at least that he was acquainted with, in terms of getting someone to teach the methods course, which sounds similar to what you said, that it was kind of like on an ad hoc.
Oh no, the methods course was an entirely different question. If you're talking about the content of the methods course,
well, that and that there was some reluctance on the part of the economics department to provide personnel to teach the methods course to the IR students.
Oh, no, heavens no. Whoever told you that is making an institutional factor out of personal preferences. In the 60s, when we first started the whole methods course and so on, I got Glenn Kane, a teacher from Econ. Mike Aiken, a teacher from Sociology, and then another guy from Sociology to teach it, whose name I can't remember. And then we got Don Schwab and others to teach you from the business school. And each year as the director, you got to get somebody who will teach a course. And Glenn was going off someplace where he wanted to teach something else. But there was never a departmental restriction on who would teach methods.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't in this university for the most part. People teach what they want to teach. So the problem was to find who would like to teach the research methods course. And I have no idea who told you that econ or business or anybody was opposed to the methods course, because that's not true. We never had any problem of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
My problem as director and the problem that the other directors had was who would teach it.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd we get the money for it? Are you confusing the problem of departmentalization?
I think this may have led into that or been part of that, though I know that that's a separate issue which I wanted you to speak to, in fact. So if you
Because there's never been any problem on courses. Anytime IR wanted to offer a course, it decided that it would like to do so and went through the regular university procedures, and Econ has never blocked any IR course, mm-hmm. nor has business.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the people within Econ and within business who are in the IR Institute would have views about the appropriateness of offering it. But the trade people and the macro and the micro people up here could care less about what the Institute was doing, and the same was true over business in terms of the accounting and finance. Now, some of the labor economists here and some of the people in management and organization and business, wearing their other hats as members of the IR faculty, had their own particular oxes to gore. But that should not reflect in any way on the departments from which they came,
mm-hmm.
because they were acting as individuals, not as representatives of departments.
Mm-hmm. One thing I noticed when going through the IRRI reports briefly was that there was an emphasis in research, and I think in conferences also, on one was manpower training, and the other was on international studies, which seemed to have emerged around that time, if not a little earlier, certainly by your second time as director. I wanted to know why, whether this is a valid observation, and second, what was the driving force behind this?
Answer the second one first. Money.
Uh-huh.
And general views on what constituted a sound training for a student in industrial relations. Originally, we had a research program designed for people getting PhDs. Gradually, the master's program became much larger than the PhD program, at which point some of the people talked about a professional degree, such as Cornell has a master's in industrial relations rather than an MA. And out of all of this came the notion that we should have a required program, as opposed to the old idea where a person just said, I'm going to major in this, minor in this, and got permission of his major professor and went ahead and did this. We had a very loose sort of thing. If you look at the old bulletins, they'll give you an idea what the program was. So then we converted over, and I guess this was during my first administration. It may have been started during Jerry's, I can't really remember. And I may have been involved in it during that time, so it may have occurred then. We set up our four fields, unions and collective bargaining, personnel and organizational behavior, international, and wages and manpower.
Mm-hmm.
And said students, in order to get a master's degree, would have to take the basic course in each of the four areas, plus the second course, and so on. We also then watered down the thesis and gave a non-thesis option, and in effect, under the MA or MS label, put in a professional degree program.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I might expand a little bit on the idea of money as a motivator. We hired Everett Caslow, and he came here with great ideas on raising funds to expand our international program. These were not successful. He never raised a penny. And so that our international program did not go too well. Saul Levine, who had been brought in by Henry Hill, also in the international area, was not successful in raising new money, so that when our Ford money ran out, our international program became much more limited. Both Saul and Everett are great scholars and great teachers, but we were not able to get large grants which would enable us to finance PhD education in the international field the way we had been able to with government money and Ford money.
Mm-hmm.
So that international may be one of the areas, which unfortunately is on the way out around the country. And that's because there are just not too many jobs there for PhD students, and not too much financing, and therefore fewer students going into that area, which is sort of sad given the fact that the world is more closely integrated than ever before, and we should turn out more students in this field.
Mm-hmm.
But we are just unable to find support for that area.
Do you remember, along the same line, significant conferences during your directorship, the ones that stand out in your mind as being particularly memorable?
We didn't have many conferences.
Mm-hmm.
None stand out in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Our main job was to teach our courses and grant degrees and get money and do research and turn out books and articles.
Mm-hmm.
Conferences were a very small part. In fact, I don't think we would have conferences year in and year out. A conference was a rare occasion.
Can you describe your connection with the efforts to departmentalize the Institute?
I favored it, but I don't think I was as strong for it as some of my colleagues. I think you've got access to the papers, which really tell the story better than any of us can tell it. In effect, we were bought off by having the university as an administration meet specific needs. At least that was what happened during my time. I said we should have a tenure track. Well, why? You don't need a tenure track. Who do you want to hire? We'll let you bring him in as a visitor. So that the particular needs that we had during the early days were met without any trouble. And there are arguments against departmentalization that are valid ones and good ones, and we were doing well as an interdisciplinary program. Our problems came up during my second administration, not during the first. By this time, we had lost our people from sociology. Mike Aiken had left, Bob Alford had left, Chick Perot had left, and these are three sociologists who had an interest in the Industrial Relations Research Institute. And sociology was hiring people who did not have an interest in the Institute. The same sort of thing was holding true in all departments, including economics. We were hiring econometricians rather than institutional labor economists. At which stage, we started arguing that we needed to have a tenure track. And I was unsuccessful in getting departmentalization through, and each of my successors has been unsuccessful. And instead, what has developed is that we have been encouraged, and I guess this came up during my regime, encouraged to work with other departments. And the dean has given us a little clout by, in effect, saying that IR will pay for part of the man or woman, and that person will have a tenure home elsewhere. So I can recall distinctly a meeting where I was so pleased with myself, and I was reporting that we had hired Paula Voos and Sam Cohen, and Everett Caslow, who had been on leave in Washington, came back and says, "My God," he says, "you mean to tell me that we are replacing Summers and Barbash with Voos and Cohen?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, who ever heard of Voos and Cohen?" I said, "Who ever heard of Summers and Brabash when they were 25? Well, Paul's got tenure, so we're okay there, but I don't know about Sam. you may want to find out. I gather that's still up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
But if Sam doesn't get tenure, then we got to start all over with sociology. And what happens to that slot that we had invested there?
Mm-hmm.
Because he was teaching for us, and half his or a quarter of his salary was paid for out of the IR budget.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Paul is an investment that's worked out. So it's a very difficult thing to achieve, to operate without a tenure track. And Cronin and Shane and others have said, well, if it won't work, then we would reconsider departmentalization. And Hansen has been aware of this, but, we're successful. And then, by the way, I should take that back about sociology, too, because we're getting, what's his name, an international
Shrek.
To replace, yeah,
mm-hmm.
to replace Everett.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really a very good arrangement there. And since he's coming in at the tenure level, we don't have to worry about that.
What that meant seems some sort of like code a little, but what that's referring to, and from there, if you could discuss a little bit the role of the TAA in these two proceedings.
Well, you first have to go back to IRGSA and how it started. Jerry Summers probably should get the credit for starting IRGSA. He believes strongly in student participation, and I inherited that and had no objection to it. So that we put students on all of our committees, we put them on our executive committee, contrary to university regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And when the people in the central administration heard about it, they sent us little memos and notes and so on. So that's why we created an administrative committee. Because on the administrative committee, we could put our assistant professors and everybody else who doesn't have tenure. And we even had students there. Up here in Econ, we called it an extended department meeting, where we had undergraduate and graduate representatives. And at the conclusion of the meeting, we asked them to leave, and then we had a one-minute regular department meeting where we voted to approve everything that had been done in the extended department. So we were doing the same sort of thing down in IR. We were just taking the econ tradition, and Summers probably should get the blame or credit for it more than me or any of the others who came after him. Students responded to that very well. I can recall when we first put a student on the admissions committee, and all the faculty talked about how gabby students are and they couldn't keep a secret and so forth. And my experience with students over the 7 or 8 years I was director is that they were always excellent members of the admissions and aid committee and took their responsibilities very seriously and never were guilty of indiscretions. And I can't say the same for some of the faculty who were on the committee. And we had a couple on the executive committee, and we still do, I guess. And it's been harder for the students to maintain themselves and get full representation than it was then. Initially, everybody wanted to be in it. And this general meeting you referred to, I can recall, we met upstairs, and on a Saturday morning, there'd be 50 or 60 people there, and they would discuss each of their pet gripes. Get rid of the master's exam. It doesn't do anything except scare people to death. Develop new courses. Bring in more radicals. Why do we always have the conservative visitors? And I forget who they wanted from Chicago. It was very good when we got up. But it was a very lively exchange of ideas, with the students feeling that they had the absolute right. This was their program, you see. They were going to get degrees in IR, and we were all degreed in soc, econ, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt a stronger loyalty to the program, in their own opinion, than they thought we had. So that's the sort of thing we talked about. So then IRGSA got formed, and I assume you've seen the picture of the initial officers. Marchetti, Peterson, and so on. Well, you ought to interview Thatcher.
Who was the name?
Thatcher Peterson. He works for Oshkosh Truck as a labor relations type. He's gone terribly conservative.
Oh.
But you could ask him about the early days. Call him up. He'd be glad to talk with you about it. I don't know where the others are.
I actually have an appointment to talk to Marchetti. He's in,
oh, do
he's
you?
In Massachusetts, yeah.
Well, how are you going
to do it by phone?
Are you going to do it by phone? Well, he'd be the one to get.
Yeah.
Shall we talk about Marchetti for a while?
By all means, yeah.
Okay. He walked into my office up front, and he was an undergraduate, early 60s, and said, should he go into the international field or into the labor industrial relations field? I told him to go into the international field because I thought that it would be much more exciting in the years to come than the labor field will, which with unions and collective bargaining, I didn't think were really going to be expanding greatly. So naturally, in his rebellious fashion, he picked labor. Then the guy who we had lined up to get a 3-year NSF, National Science Foundation Graduate Fellowship, couldn't come. So we had an extra one we had to get rid of in a hurry. And there was Marchetti wanting it. So I suggested to Jerry, let's give it to Marchetti, which we did. So Jim was a close friend, a student, and I was working on some manpower stuff on armor plant closings, and Jim did his master's thesis on that under me and did an excellent job. Very good student and so forth. Then I was teaching a course for the engineers, and I thought they ought to learn a little bit about what was going on in campus. So I got Hasley, Browder, and the third one, whose name has escaped me, who were the leaders of the TAA.
Mm-hmm.
And this was back, pre-Dow maybe, or Dow. And they came over and talked to the engineers, who were shocked to find out that this was going on the other side of campus. And it proved so interesting that I had these three do their repeat performance for a class, which I had here, and I invited Marchetti and some of the other IR students in. Well, I did not anticipate the kind of reaction that they had. By this time, Dow had occurred, and the TAA was trying to organize itself to be a mass organization. And our IR students found that Muhlenkamp from English, Haslick from math, Brad or wherever he was from, were totally incompetent as organizers, in their opinion. So Marchetti, being a very strong character, decided, okay, we're going to take over this TAA and we're going to show them what to do. With his leadership and the others from our institute, they really provided a great deal of collective bargaining savvy for the TAA. The ideological basis for the TAA, I think, was formulated by these others who I've mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And our IR students really came in later and attempted to take that ideology and transfer it into bargaining.
Mm-hmm.
So, IRGSA then, which had been formed by Marchetti and the others, immediately then had to get into the TAA, so to speak. I mean, it was much easier the same way those of us running the institute were out of econ. We had to do it that way. There was some friction between students and faculty over this thing, because when the TAs were marching up and down the campus and breaking windows and so on, the notion came up that maybe, and this was not the organization doing it, you know, it was different student groups or different students, maybe there was some way to work out group relationships, so that along with Bob Mulvihill and Ed Young, I met secretly someplace over there in that great Tower of Babel with a couple of representatives to discuss whether they would be interested in approaching this from a collective bargaining point of view. They turned out to be interested in it, so Ed Young then asked Arlen Christensen, Bri Curl, me, Dave Berman, to be the team that would meet with the TAs and work this out. And we developed what was called a structure agreement. And the structure agreement provided that the university would recognize the TAA if the TAA would win an election and would go ahead and bargain with it. And we also arranged at that point for one of our students to be hired by the university to represent the university, a fellow by the name of Neil Buckland, mm-hmm. who you might also interview after you talk to Marchetti. And then Jim became the bargainer for the TAs. There was some feeling on the part of Irv Shane and others that this was a stern practicum, that this was a way of getting students of his financed. This was totally untrue, but I would say that the reputation of the Industrial Relations Research Institute did not benefit in front of the regents and our top administrators by our involvement. I don't include Ed Young in that thing because he knew everybody well enough so that he wasn't bothered by it. But I think some of our other faculty friends were sort of aghast at what was going on.
Who did you say represented the TAA? Who was from the department?
Marchetti.
Oh, Marchetti, okay.
Yeah, he became, in effect, along with Muhlenkamp, their chief bargainer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this led to a problem because the students had the opinion then that how could they genuflect before their faculty when they were supposed to, on the next day, appear as equals in a bargaining session and their faculty was on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So this eventually led to a famous rupture between Marchetti and me, which he can tell you about, but which essentially I said he wasn't doing any damn work and therefore I gave him a U or something like that. And he therefore said that I was unfair to him and that I should resign as his major, no, that I should be removed as his major professor. At which point I sent him back my one-liner, I hereby resign. And, no, he essentially got carried away with his belief that this was a good organization, something should be done about it. And he was an excellent organizer. He's not a good bargainer. He's too gung-ho. He had some problems here with another friend of mine down Eaton, who the Teamsters, and you can get that whole story, but that's way beyond the Institute.
Mm-hmm. Within the Institute, was there, without naming names, was there faculty problems between the faculty, between those who were, like yourself, who were interested in, or did become involved in the process, and those who were just opposed to the TAA, or on principle, or?
It really wasn't that important. In terms of the Institute structure, I knew that certain people there were very sympathetic. We had three groups. We had those who thought anything the TAA guys did was fine, those who thought anything they did was terrible, and those who on some issues were for them and some were against them. But we didn't have to do anything in the Institute. We didn't have to vote on any way about this, and so that it never really interfered with the running of the Institute itself.
Mm-hmm.
Our students on committee still functioned well. Our admissions functioned well. All of our committees went well. There was no problem about that. The students would be mad at us for not supporting them in the university as a whole. We'd be mad at them for getting us in trouble, that sort of thing. But mm-hmm. No, it didn't carry over into the Institute structure. We didn't have any problems that way. In fact, the only problem, I guess, was Stern Marchetti didn't get along after getting along so famously. There's a cute story about that. He went over to Milwaukee to get support from the labor movement, and he met with the big shots over there, and one of them, a fellow by the name of Harvey Kitzman, now deceased, said, "Okay, we believe you. We're going to help you. Now, I have a very influential friend over there, and I'm going to call him up and make sure that he really gets on your side. You're going to have to meet him." Marchetti asks who, and he says Jim Stern.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, our relations with the labor movement, by our, I mean Ed Young's, mine, and the others, was better than the TAA's. And that was one of the problems that came up, not for the Institute, but for the poor TAA's, because the labor leaders were not particularly sympathetic to the notion of students running the campus, and that's the way they saw it. They saw the students' desire to have greater input into what is taught, how it's taught, and so on, as running the campus, and therefore the unions were lined up fairly solidly behind the administration, which had done a good job of contacting the union people, telling them what the issues were, and so on, so that our students were unable to get support, except from the Teamsters,
mm-hmm.
which was interesting.
Hmm.
But incidentally, all of this has been recorded, you know.
This is down the oral history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They talked to Arlen, to Nate, to me, to Ed, to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So back to the Institute.
I wanted to talk about efforts to recruit minorities during your administration, if you could speak to that a little bit.
We made phone calls and in a disorganized fashion tried to get the word out that we wanted minority students. We really didn't know how to do it. We would call up places where we thought there would be undergraduates and hope through this method to get them, and it was very informal, and we did get black students. We got them in greater numbers then than we do now, but it was still very, very small. Oh boy, I have trouble remembering names now. Once we got hold of a student, so to speak, we did everything we could to make sure he got his financial aid, and we kept him in. For example, Lucian Gatewood, who came out of Kent State, got a master's program, then went back out into the world, and we got him back to get his PhD. And each one of the students we had was almost an accident. Somebody out of one of the colleges knew that we would be helpful if it was a minority, and we did so.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a few, but not as many as we should. Mm-hmm. Right now, I don't think we have any, do we? In terms of domestic black?
I don't think we do.
No.
Not to my knowledge. I haven't met everyone yet.
No.
Not to my knowledge. Were there any very evident trends in the curriculum for both master's and PhD students in terms of, you spoke a little bit about it in terms of getting rid of some requirements, and but in terms of the departmental or the composition of the curriculum,
mm-hmm.
as far as disciplines were concerned, do you see a shift towards or away from?
No. Of course, you didn't finish that. Toward or away from what?
From, say, towards more courses in what would be considered the realm of economics and what would be consider sociology, and whether there's a de-emphasis on psychology or that sort of things.
I think we had our big reform during my first administration, where we set up this four-course area and where we got our PhD program with our inside and outside minors, and that happened during summer's time and during mine. Since then, the modifications have been minor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you should realize that a lot of the modifications are caused by faculty interests.
Mm-hmm.
Faculty decide something's interesting, and faculty gets hired, then they want to offer a course. And once they offer a course, students want to get credit for it toward their degrees. So that I became interested in public sector bargaining, so we invented a couple of public sector bargaining courses. Everett was interested in international, invented a couple of international courses. The research methods thing has grown because we have people in this field who think our students need more work on quantitative analysis and more rigorous training in the scientific method, and mm-hmm. therefore have subjected the students to research methods. Now we're going to have research methods 1 and 2. But these are minor changes that reflect faculty interests and faculty beliefs of what's a good education. Psychology has dropped off a little bit because over in the business school we've had all these organizational behavior types. And psych has not really done too much. Len Berkowitz is there, but he's about the only one who's currently interested in the Institute compared to that great mass of humanity over there from the business school and management organization. What's your area? Are you,
unions and collective bargaining.
I had to make sure I wasn't insulting somebody from the business school.
Can you give me a brief description of what of your professional life since you left your last since you left in 80 in 83 and also what you did in between 70 and 83. I know you were still teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you're still teaching now.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could just briefly describe that and your connection with the Institute sort of generally since when you weren't in the position of director.
Well, and in keeping with our tradition, going back to 71, I went off to England for a year and had a lovely time. And I guess I had a Fulbright and was at Warwick. And you generate things there. I made friends there and started what has now become our Warwick connection, which I assume you're familiar with.
Mm-hmm. I will be. If I'm not already, I will be.
All right, well, that's, you know, that's where we get students from there, and we can send people there, and I've sent some of my students there. And we've even formalized it now. So that.
How is it formalized?
Well, the Chancellor of Madison and the Vice-Chancellor of Warwick agreed to a competition, whereas each side can nominate 2 people from the university as a whole. And then there's a selection committee, and then somebody goes there or somebody comes here.
Mm-hmm.
And we won the first one with Jeremy Waddington coming from there here, who was a student, one of my friends there. And then we've got Marshall, what's his name, over there now,
mm-hmm.
on that same sort of program. And then we've had students who stopped by there in the summer, Roy Adams, one of our international people, Greg Saltzman. So this goes back to the days when I was the first international visitor of Warwick and spent a year there with them. And when I came back in 72, what do you want to know? What I've been doing?
Well, when you came back in 72, you, I assume, resumed your professorship.
Right.
And then, in between then and when you took on the directorship again in 79.
Well, you stay a professor the whole time. Remember, that directorship's just a half-time job.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And since 1983, you left the directorship, you've been teaching part-time here and spending...
I'm not sure what you're after, Amy. I mean, the easiest thing for me to do is just get out an old Vita.
Okay.
And then you can just see. I mean, in terms of what I did after I stopped being director in 71, essentially I spent a little more time on research and was able to get a grant from the Department of Labor to study final offer arbitration and produced a book by that same name. Then moved into labor relations and urban transit and was able to help several of our students finance their dissertations that way, and we put out different articles and monographs on transportation. Then he got another grant to study strikes and strike penalties in the public sector. Mainly during this time, I have been doing research on the public sector. Also during that period, I became active as a labor arbitrator and active also in the National Academy of Arbitrators, which is the professional association for that group. Then during my second term as directorship, I had an interesting experience. A Brazilian professor shows up and wants to be helped, so we sent him up to the library and got him situated there, then showed him the IRRA, then I took him out on arbitrations. He was a very nice man, and we were very nice to him. His name was José Pastore. When he was leaving, he mentioned that he was also an assistant to the Minister of Labor down there, and would we be able to handle some technical assistance for the Brazilian government. So the fact that Barbara Dennis and others had been very nice to this guy, and we had given him space, and he had gotten along well with Barbash and Skidmore and Ken Miracle and the others, turned into a grant that ran over $500,000. So this came to fruition during the time I was director the second time, so that we had Brazilians coming at our ears. We had short-term training, and we weren't organized to do any of this. We put them up at Friedrich Center and ran, I guess they were six-week courses. I got Ken Miracle to do much of the teaching for them. Dick Miller helped out, and others did. And in addition to those courses, which were taught in English, we also did one for their judges and another one for a group of lawyers, I guess, and government workers, where we had to use simultaneous interpretation and paid translators. That was a mess. Those were short courses, two-week courses. In addition, we sent people down to Brazil. For example, they wanted to know about arbitration, so I canvassed the National Academy of Arbitrators, and to my amazement, found two arbitrators who spoke fluent Portuguese. And so we arranged for them to go down and give lectures. And one of them, John Dorr, also then was helpful to us when we had these teams up here. So in terms of what I did then in the 80s, I guess this was mainly this Brazil project, which went on till 84. Then in 84, after teaching in the first semester, I developed this new syndrome, which is to avoid Wisconsin winters. So I had in the meantime, between 71 and the 80s, developed contacts in Australia and spent a year down there in 76. I forgot about that. And then on the way back, stopped by Hawaii and made some contacts there, and then spent a semester there in 79. So by the time 84 came around, in my second semester, I spent the first 2 months in Hawaii and the next 2 months at the London School of Economics, renewing my English friends as well as my Hawaiian friends. And I became addicted to it, and ever since I've done the same thing. So now I am retired, am emeritus, and I'm on a half-time basis. So that I teach in the fall, and then in the winter I can go back to Hawaii or England or Brazil or Australia. And in 84 I went to England and Hawaii, 85 Hawaii, 86 Hawaii, 87 Hawaii, and Australia. So I'm having a very tough life.
You're nice.
Actually, in terms of the half-time, what it means is you just teach in the fall, but it doesn't mean you're really half-time. I mean, students insist on writing chapters and sending them to you during the second semester as well as the first semester. So that what it really means is I only teach in the first semester, but I'm still around here the rest of the time, summer and fall.
I want to ask you a general, more profound question. What is your opinion as to the future of the study of industrial relations, both at Wisconsin and generally?
Oh, I think it'll continue. Institutions adapt. when Salk and Sabin invented their cures for infantile paralysis, you would have thought that the March of Dimes campaign would have dried up, that institution would have gone away. But no, instead they just adopted a new disease, birth defects, so that staff keeps going. So in the same sense, I think an institute like ours will keep going.
Mm-hmm.
It'll change. It may have more emphasis on affirmative action, on OSHA, on labor management cooperation, on employee involvement. It may even have more interest in non-union affairs. I personally don't regard this as an advance, but as a sort of part of the staying process that institutions go through.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we will still rely on collective bargaining in this country to a great degree. And in the public sector, I don't see any signs of evaporation. So I suppose I take that very dull social scientist point of view that things will continue about the way they are.
Mm-hmm. That's all I had to ask. I wanted to know if you wanted to say anything else on the record before I turn off the machine.
No, in terms of our 40-year history.
Yeah.
Well, I would just mention to you that as one who's supervising the history for the National Academy of Arbitrators, and who's just videotaped some of our old-timers and then audiotaped some of the others, that I wouldn't rely on anything any of us tell you. That, as far as I can tell, memories are awfully tricky.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to do an awful lot of work with the papers.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've watched these men say something that I knew was untrue, but they can remember they were there.
Mm-hmm.
But they're talking about 1947, and the piece of paper says something other than what they're saying now verbally.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you read them the piece of paper, they say, oh, yeah, I guess it was that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I would plead guilty to the same things. I would hope that you can get old records out, minutes of executive committee meetings. For example, you asked me about that meeting we had with students.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bet there's a record of that meeting someplace.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Oh, I guess you also ought to make some reference to our library. You ought to cover that in some
yeah.
way.
Mm-hmm.
Will you be talking to somebody?
Well, what I'd like for you to speak about that. I know that it was renamed in honor of Professor Summers, and that it initially was a project of the Institute, but I'd like for you to elaborate on that.
It started out way, way back as a place where people just put their pamphlets and so on. It was called the Black Box Collection. And they had as a person running it a secretary who nobody could stand. They didn't know what to do with her until she retired. And she was down in the space that's presently where the IR office is. Then when the new building went up, which was a year later, this is the new building compared to the old building, we used the space upstairs for the library. We moved our Black Box Collection up there. We hired a second librarian and started the Vocational and Technical Center Library up there. Then we got the poverty grant, and that went up there. And then sociology, econ, Anthro decided, okay, this will make a good building library. We won't have to face the cold and go down the hill. We were fighting at that time. Lou Kaplan, the librarian, who didn't believe in having remote libraries. He thought everybody ought to come down to Memorial where he could guard the books personally and see that everything was okay. So these weren't even libraries. They were called reading rooms or something of that nature. And we financed them out of our various budgets. Then, and we ran the library.
Mm-hmm.
As director, each time I would be hiring librarians and going over budgets and things like that. During my second administration, I figured out that we ought to get rid of that library, and that was one of the things that I did achieve. I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm.
I made a trade with the librarian, whatever his name was, Joe Kaufman?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that's right.
That didn't sound right. Kaufman is a, somebody over in higher ed. But at any rate, the librarian before the present one.
Mm-hmm.
And we gave up the position. We owned a position. He had plenty of money, but he didn't have positions, so he was quite willing to trade. And we gave up our position, and he had the money, and we integrated the reading room into the library system.
Mm-hmm.
And there are documents on that. There were committee meetings, and there are women in the building who can tell you about it. Maggie Sullivan over at L&S used to be in the same job that Sally has, and she can tell you what went on. Finding Bowen and others, and a woman up in sociology, because the faculty was pretty bad. They would not meet their responsibilities, and instead we gave them to our staff to handle.
Mm-hmm.
But the library is important. One of the things that's happened, which is bad, is the State Historical Society has not really been able to maintain its interest in labor. This dates back from the time when Les Fischel left and went to Ohio, and budgets have been tight.
Mm-hmm.
That's about all I can think of for the tape.
Mm-hmm.